A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promoting for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture. With me, Neil Denny. This week, writer Andy Miller tells me how 50 great books saved his life in the year of reading dangerously. Andy Miller is a reader, author, and editor of books. His writing has appeared in numerous publications, including The Times, The Telegraph, The Guardian, Esquire, and Mojo. He's the author of Tilting at Windmills, How I Tried to Stop Worrying and Love Sport, among others. His latest book is The Year of Reading Dangerously, How 50 Great Books Saved My Life. So, Andy, thank you very much for joining me on Little Atoms today.
Thank you very much.
And I'm going to say, just as a brief introduction to this, that a couple of years back, people who follow me on Twitter might remember that I had an abortive attempt to try and read a series of classic books, which inevitably, due to my Little Atoms workload, I gave up on. So I was delighted to read your book where you basically attempt the same thing, to tackle a series of classic novels. So let's talk first of all about where this idea came from. Why did you do it?
Well, I'm always keen to say about this when people ask me that the idea came before the book, and the idea was no more than that I got to about the age of 35 and I came up with what I thought was a hilarious wheeze, which was to read a dozen books that I had at various points lied about having read. And so I didn't draw up a list, but I would have like books that would fit that category, like The Master and Margarita or Middlemarch or Moby Dick. And I would talk about this project an awful lot and I would amuse myself and others while talking about it. And then I turned 36 and then I turned 37 and then I turned 38 and 40 was getting closer and I hadn't read any of these books. And almost as a dare to myself, I thought, well, you can BS about this forever or you could actually do it. So I decided I would sit down and consciously read a dozen books that I'd lied about having read. So I read, well, we'll talk about this in a bit, but I read, say, maybe 9 or 10 of them, and I got sort of midway through Anna Karenina and just thought, I've got to write about this. It was such an amazing, energising experience for something which was fundamentally just sitting there reading books. Mm-hmm. I had no ambitions to write anything at that point, actually, and I certainly didn't envisage writing about this, but I was so gripped by it and seized by it and seized with the, you know, the things that it was doing to my brain that at that point I thought, well, I've got to write about this. I didn't know how I'd write about it. I didn't know what form it would take, but just the experience of reading things, you know, and settling. I describe it in the book as settling a debt. I mean, to put some context around the very nice introduction you gave me, I'm a reader, a writer, and an editor of books. I've worked in publishing a long time. I've worked in bookselling a long time. My whole life has been books, really.
Yeah.
I loved books when I was a kid, and I've made my professional life around books. And as I got older, I was thinking, well, you've made some shortcuts, and you probably ought not to have done that. So,
well, this was going to be my next question. So, you know, as you mentioned, you've worked in bookshops, you've worked in publishing, you've written other books. But you weren't reading, so why was it, do you think, that you weren't reading?
Well, partly I'm going to give you the excuse of that it's just professional expediency.
Mm-hmm.
That when you are, well, you must know what this is like. When you work in the book world, in whatever, you know, you could be a reviewer or you could run a podcast like you do or you could be an editor like I was, you are asked to read an awful lot of things that you would not normally choose to read. That would not be to your taste, that you would not select yourself. And because you have to read those things as a matter of professional expediency, as I say, that necessarily means you don't have time to read stuff that you do want to read naturally because of wherever your tastes or interests lie. And when you do come to read that stuff, it tends to feel like the clock is ticking.
Yeah.
You're rewarding yourself in some way, which in its own turn seems a bit unnatural to me. So, you know, I was reading a lot. I was reading all the time. But the truth of it is I was reading like 30 pages of things and being asked to make snap judgments on them based not on what my taste might be necessarily,
yeah,
but on where they might fit in the marketplace. Or I think reviewers must have this as well, actually. People who review regularly, where they're looking at a book and they're seeking to find where it fits in the cultural landscape. Mm. And
you do talk particularly about that in terms of working in bookshops, for instance, and mm-hmm. how that might, I guess, put you off a lot of books.
Yeah, well, the thing about working in bookshops is, and I talk about this in the book specifically, which is that when you go to work in a bookshop, I think that, I mean, I love working in a bookshop, but you tend to think, well, I'll have the opportunity to meet people who like the things that I do. Mm-hmm. But actually, you know, that probably won't happen. You'll meet far more people who either don't like the things that you do, or more specifically, like things you don't like.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I talk about... I specifically talk about the difference in the book between if one goes into the book trade expecting to meet a lot of people who like Tolstoy, you're going to be disappointed. You're going to meet a lot more people who like Alan Titchmarsh mm-hmm. and the novels of Alan Titchmarsh. So you necessarily have to form a way of protecting your own sincere love while doing your job properly,
mm-hmm.
and which is probably to tell fibs about it.
Because, of course, Alan Titchmarsh is going to sell a lot more novels than Tolstoy.
Absolutely, and when somebody comes in and says to you, with a copy of the new Alan Titchmarsh in their hand, have you read this? Is it good? They don't want to hear you say either, no, I haven't read it, do I look like the sort of person who would read Alan Titchmarsh? Or, yes, I have read it, and it was crap. You know, what does the customer want of you in your role as a bookseller? They want you to say something like, either I've read it, yeah, it was great, fantastic, you've made a brilliant choice, or, well, I'm afraid I haven't read it, but I hear he's terrific, you know. I mean, I have to say, I chose Alan Titchmarsh for a very specific reason, which is, at the age of 46, to get back at my mum. Who loves Alan Titchmarsh? You know, I bought her a copy of Brideshead Revisited, my mum. My mum is in her early 80s, and we've been up to Castlehaven, Chatsworth. Oh, they're revealing my ignorance. But we've been up and we've visited. I said, oh, you might like Brideshead Revisited. And she read Brideshead Revisited by Evelyn Waugh at the age of 80. And she said, and this is she's exactly what she said. She said, well, I quite liked Andrew. She's the only person who calls me Andrew. I quite liked Andrew. But it wasn't nearly as good as the last Alan Titchmarsh. And she meant it. She wasn't being arch. She wasn't
that
being
be true.
You know, no, perhaps that's true. Absolutely. But yeah, so to some extent, I mean, I'm wearing two hats here. One ought not to lie about these things. But at the same time, if you're doing that job properly, you need to get over yourself a bit and realise that you're their customer service, and what the customer wants is someone to approve of the thing that they're going to buy. So,
what about lying about books more generally then? Because there are books that, you know, we all have on our shelves, perhaps we've bought meaning to read at one point. Is it Alan Bennett who says, there's a quote from Alan Bennett where he says that, you know, there's a class of books, the sort of Pride and Prejudice and stuff, that people perhaps think they've read, even though they might not necessarily have.
He says, definition of a classic, a book that everybody is supposed to have read and often thinks they have. Well, that's absolutely right, isn't it? I mean, I found it very interesting with this book. I had felt at some level that I was the only sinner in this area, that I had developed a particularly acute bad habit of having fibbed about. Not meaning to lie about it, but, you know, if you and I were having a conversation, Neil, about Moby Dick... It would be easier to just assume a familiarity with Moby Dick, which one would have, because one's heard a lot about Moby Dick through being culturally alert and interested in seeing films and TV things. And, you know, it was much easier to go with the flow rather than go, I have to stick my hand up here and say I haven't actually read Moby Dick. That, you know, that's quite a brave and actually socially maladroit thing to do. You probably wouldn't do that. So it wasn't that I was actively going out to deceive people. But yeah, I think in general, I probably was eliding a certain amount of cultural knowledge and actual truth. One of the delights about talking about this book and publishing this book is not everyone, but quite a lot of people seem to feel they need to do the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's more from a position of wanting to fit in and wanting to be liked. Nothing more sinister than that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I talk in the book about Zelig, the Woody Allen film Zelig, and in Zelig, the root of his personality problem is when he was asked why he thought about Moby Dick. And when he was asked why he lies about it, he says, because I want to be liked. That seems to me entirely true.
I'm Jonathan Meads, and you're listening to Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture.
There are certain things that are so pervade culture. So I mentioned Pride and Prejudice particularly because it's a book that, you know, I've never read, or at least I've never finished, because it was one of the ones, I think probably the one I was reading when I realised that my Little Atoms responsibilities were not going to allow me to keep up with reading the classic novels. And it's something I've attempted numerous times in the past. But I have seen the BBC series, and I have seen the Keira Knightley film numerous times and really love it, and I know the names of all the characters, I know the story, and I know it's a book stroke film. I know it's a story that I could have a conversation with somebody about and not get caught out, and probably know more about it than somebody that's read the book once 10 years ago. So I'd feel quite confident about lying that I'd read that book.
Yeah, I'm struggling to think of a really good reason why you should. I had read some of Pride and Prejudice 20 years ago and really disliked it. And one of the things I learned from doing this project was that my opinion is not necessarily correct, nor is it entirely healthy to presuppose that what I think about a book trumps what a series of experts think about it. We can talk about this in relation to other books, but certainly in terms of Pride and Prejudice, I kind of felt, well, if I was going to sustain a position of only quite liking it, I had to read it properly. And what I would say about Pride and Prejudice is actually the artistry of the way in which it is written is the thing that elevates it above what you know about the plot. So while you would be able to bluff your way with great confidence, as we all would, on that subject, actually the clockwork mechanism of it is so beautiful, in fact, that you can't soak that up. It's mixing my metaphors terribly. Can you soak up a clockwork mechanism? No, you can't. But you know what I mean. The only way you can appreciate it is to engage with it. Mm-hmm. And that is one of the things that I found while I was doing this reading. Actually, you're entitled to your opinion, but your opinion is necessarily more valid if it's based on something you actually know that you're, what you're talking about, you know. What I wouldn't say is that I had an epiphany while reading Pride and Prejudice. Pride and Prejudice is a really difficult one, though. I mean, it's a really good one to choose because,
again, it's a good one to talk about now because I want to talk about the rules that you set yourself in terms of reading the book, one of which is you should always finish a book. It's important to read a book and finish. And yet it is Pride and Prejudice that you particularly talk about in the book, in the section where you're reading it, of getting to the point where you think, well, why, there's no point in me finishing this?
Yeah.
You know, what would it matter if I didn't finish it?
I go out and do a little talk called Read Yourself Fitter, based around this book, where I take people through a 10-step program to cure themselves of their bad reading habits. And point 7 on this programme is if you start a book, you should finish it. And every single time I've done this now, which is, I don't know, we're up to 15 or something, people have... I did it in Lichfield and people actually booed me for saying, if you start a book, you should finish it. I've realised I'm the last person, I'm like the Gaulish village in Asterix. I'm like the last person left saying, if you start a book, you should finish it. And I think the reason for that is that consumerism is so embedded in us now. And we live in an era so much where our rights, quote unquote, as consumers are being allowed to bulldoze everything else. Mm-hmm. And so the egotism of the consumer and the idea that they must be right.
But there's so little time.
But not all books are the same. You know, you say there's so little time. Have you ever gone and looked at the customer reviews of Ulysses on Amazon? There's a load of people, furious people on Amazon who've said, oh, I bought Ulysses and I read like 5 pages of it and it was rubbish and he was just having a laugh at my expense and I took it as a personal insult back through time from James Joyce, but I've given it a 1 star because it arrived well packed. I just think, oh, come on, try harder. I talk about in the book, I've said this quite a lot, but I talk about in the book about Middlemarch, and very specifically I say Middlemarch is a long and difficult book, but if you don't like it, that's not Middlemarch's fault, that's your fault. and you need to try harder. Actually, Eleanor Catton, who won the Man Booker last year for The Luminary, she wrote a really brilliant essay on about this, again, which I've talked about quite a lot, but it's superb, where she specifically says, look, the thing we're talking about here is the gap between consumerism and art, and the two things are not very compatible. So in relation to Pride and Prejudice, and in relation to finishing a book, I mean, in my talk I say I think there are three reasons why you should finish a book. One is, you know, you're not as clever as George Eliot, okay? You don't know it all, surprise, surprise. The second reason is, well, you know, you might be pleasantly surprised. Mm-hmm. Actually, you might learn something. And the third reason is, if you don't finish the book, you don't know what you're talking about. You literally don't know what you're talking about. You can talk about your impression of the book based on what you read. And I talk about The Goldfinch by Donna Tartt. Have you read The Goldfinch?
No, I haven't yet.
Right, The Goldfinch by... Yeah. I've read The Goldfinch by Donna Tartt. It's a 700-page novel, and the first 600 pages, I read it, I was thinking, oh, this is all right. Kind of like, it's fine, it's okay. Like, windy sort of Dickens pastiche. But then in the last 30 pages, she does something incredible, in my opinion, which really changes how you view what you've read, and also has something really profound to say about how we respond to art and how we respond to culture in relation to the painting that she's talking about of this Goldfinch and etc., etc. And it radically altered how I felt about that novel. And the point is, I wouldn't have known that if I hadn't have finished it. So A, I wouldn't have had the experience, and B, I would have been wrong. But I would have been out there being wrong. Right?
I've also read reviews that say exactly the opposite, that it's great for 600 pages and then there's a pointless last section.
Well, those people are entitled to their wrong opinion. That's how I feel about that. Actually, funnily enough, I did my talk down at Port Elliot a couple of weekends ago, and somebody who'd given up on page 600 of The Goldfinch said, God damn you, Miller, I'm going to have to finish reading it now. Finish reading it, and then contacted me via Twitter angrily to say, I've read it. What were you talking about? It doesn't get any better. So, you know, these things are all gradations of opinion, aren't they?
You raised the spectre of art, talking about Eleanor Catton a moment ago, and I want to get... We're going to tackle the sort of vexed what is art question. Mainly, you know, I want to talk about what is a classic. Mainly, I want to get us to why the 50 books. Why did you choose the 50 books that you did? We've talked about a definition of a classic from Alan Bennett. So what was your definition when you were setting out to choose these?
I ought to say that... I didn't, this is quite an important point to make if anyone's not familiar with the premise of the book, that I chose books that I felt I ought to have read, but they weren't drawn exclusively from what we would call the canon. So I wasn't creating a kind of checklist of important books. I was more trying to create a kind of, almost like a memory map, actually, of books that I, over quite a long period of time, had at various points felt I ought to have read. So necessarily there were things from the canon, like Tolstoy, like Moby Dick, Pride and Prejudice, etc., etc. But there are also things from, I suppose you'd call them an alternative canon, like Post Office by Charles Bukowski, or Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas by Hunter Thompson, or The Dice Man by Luke Reinhardt. Or there were just things that somebody might have recommended to me 30 years ago that stuck in my head. I thought I really ought to get around to reading that one day. Like, there's a novel by Rex Warner called The Aerodrome, which I inexplicably stuck in my head. And I thought, oh, I ought to, this will be a good thing to read for this project. Or like Lovecraft. I read some Lovecraft, which I ended up not writing about. But Lovecraft was somebody who, as a certain kind of hipster, one felt one ought to have some working knowledge of. And I probably suggested a working knowledge of Lovecraft that I hadn't actually earned. And I write about Krautrock Sampler by Julian Cope, a book that, within my social circles of about 500 people, everyone had read, had an opinion about, could express an opinion about, but I'd bought but never actually got round to reading. So to answer your question in a very long-winded way, my definition of a classic for the purposes of this book and this reading was whatever I wanted to read next. If you're asking me what I think a classic is... Well, I'm not going to be that revolutionary. I mean, I think to some extent, they're books that one might feel are important in the historical context of literature, or in, you know, the cultural makeup of myself or you or whoever might read this book. You know, early 21st century British readers might feel they need a working knowledge of this or that book.
But a couple of those books that you just mentioned there, the, you know, Hunter S. Thompson, Bukowski... are things that were obviously a bit sort of zeitgeisty at the time. They were popular because they were countercultural, but they're still around 30, 40 years later. People are still reading those things. So what is it? Is it just longevity that will make those books into classics? Hunter S. Thompson's Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas is a classic book, I would say, because it stood the test of time.
I find Fear and Loathing... Actually, I must say, those books were the books I found hardest to read in this whole project. Because I was like about 40 when I read a lot of these books, and I should have read them when I was 15.
Yeah, sure.
You know, and actually they were the ones that I found most difficult. And actually Fear and Loathing, I've talked about this before, but Fear and Loathing I really struggle with. It's not a long book. But you know what? It's not a book. It's a long magazine article. A great magazine article, but a book, really? And a book specifically about a specific time and era, which I guess a lot of British teenagers who read it have no knowledge of or experience of, but get a real kick out of the vibrancy of the prose and the fact that it's about two blokes taking a load of drugs. Mm-hmm. I mean, which is... I don't have a problem with it, but, you know, it was a minor pleasure for me, at best, that book. And what I would say to you is that there is a sort of... There's no conspiracy around this, but there is certainly a kind of industry of cult reading which exists probably since the 1970s in a way which it didn't exist before that, into which we might roll Catcher in the Rye, Catch-22, Fear and Loathing, The Dice Man, On the Road. You know, books that you would have been able to, maybe you still can, wander into HMV or FOP and find copies of, which are almost like a, you know, an off-the-shelf cult reading list if you're 15, 16. I didn't read a lot of those books when I was a teenager because, honestly, because they were American and they seemed really obvious choices to me. You know, and this wasn't a put-on. I wanted to read Colin McInnes and Philip Larkin and Graham Greene because they spoke to me louder than a lot of those American writers.
I'm Gaia Vince, and you're listening to Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture.
As we go into the second or third parts of the show, I want to start looking at... We'll choose some of the books that you chose from the 50 to talk around and about, you know, why you chose them, what you got out of them. But let's start with one, which is... You just mentioned Colin McInnes, Absolute Beginners, which is, I think, one of only a couple of the 50 you chose that you'd actually read before. The whole point of the thing was to be
That's
books
right.
that you hadn't read. But this is one, so I'd like to know why you chose to include it, but let's talk about why you love that book so, really.
I read Absolute Beginners by Colin McInnes when I was 15, and it's the only book, really, honestly, that I would say has ever changed my life. I mean, lots of books have affected me and lots of books have had an influence on me. But in terms of reading a book and not being the same person I was when I finished reading it as I was when I started reading it, that's the one. I'm 46 years old. I've realised when I've been talking about Absolute Beginners that you have to be my age or a bit older to remember how important that book was in the early 1980s, which is when I was 15. As soon as the film came out in the mid-1980s, it killed the book stone dead. In fact, people listening to this may have seen the film or may have heard of the film. It's a terrible film, and it ruined the reputation of the book retrospectively. I say it changed my life. Reading the book changed my life because I grew up near Croydon. I grew up in quite a conservative household, in all senses of the word. Reading this book just made me a much more liberal person in terms of the music that I listened to and how I thought about certain political issues and... But also when I read it now and when I went back and read it again, there's an incredible freedom to the prose which owes nothing to anything that I'd read up to that point and actually owes very little to anything else that I subsequently read and indeed owes very little to any other books by Colin McInnes. I mean, McInnes has his moments, but that book is far and away his best novel, set in Notting Hill in the late 1950s over one very hot summer, segueing into the race riots. I think I'm right in saying 59 is when those race riots happened. And I reread it for this project because I hadn't read it for many years. I went into it thinking, oh God, I'm going to be so disappointed if I don't like this. Actually, I almost liked it too much. I read it and thought, wow, it was a fantastic thing to read again because I actually read it and thought, wow, when I was 15, I had my head screwed on the right way. This is an amazing, amazing book. What an amazing book. How wonderful to discover that you're the same person. You've changed a lot. You know, all your skin is different, all your bones are different, and yet at the same time, your essence is unchanged. And I found it, the only downside of reading it is the next book that I read, which was 100 Years of Solitude by Gabriel Garcia Marquez. I hated, which I know a lot of people love that, but I hated it so much. And part of the reason I hated it so much is because it wasn't Absolute Beginners. Mm-hmm. So, have you read Absolute Beginners?
No.
Did you want to read it after reading Reading Dangerously?
Yes, but it did strike me as one of those... I mean, you mentioned all of the American books, and all of those ones that you mentioned, the On the Roads, the Catcher in the Rye, Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, are books that I read. They're all very blokey books, of course, but they were books that I read when I was 15, 16, 17. And then the ones that I have read subsequently, I've thought, these are awful. These are the books that a 15, 16, 17-year-old... boy should read and enjoy and like, but they're not really books that any sensible adult would like. And I wanted to talk particularly about Absolute Beginners, and I enjoyed the fact that it turned out that it was still great. He still did like it. It was the classic example of a book I thought you should have read and thought, oh God, that was shit. Why did I like this?
We have to acknowledge that there might be a happy twin event going on, which is the things that you liked about it when you were 15 and not the same things that you like about it
of course
now you're 40, but they just happen, it happens to work on two different levels at two different times. I must say, in regards to the American cult books, that I don't want to, it's unfair of me actually to write them all off in that way. When I read American Psycho, which I don't actually write about in the book, but when I read American Psycho, I absolutely loved that, but I loved it. I was about to damn it with faint praise and say I loved it as a technical achievement. That's not right. I did love it as a technical achievement, but I absolutely loved the carnage of it as well, by which I mean not just the killings in it, but the glee with which it's use the word appropriately, executed throughout, you know, that he knows he's onto a good thing when he's writing that, but you can feel it in the prose. You can feel that he's energised by what he's doing.
It's interesting that you've read that book. I don't think that's necessarily a book that I would put with those, the books I've just called books that you should read when you're 15 years old books. But I think it's interesting that you've read it out of the sort of the zeitgeisty context. When that book came out, it was massively controversial, and I read it at the time. I don't particularly like it, don't particularly think it's a great book, although I haven't read it since. But I read it at the time you were supposed to read it. Do you know what I mean? When it was the thing. Whereas it's interesting that you say it stands up so well and you enjoyed it so much 10, 15 years later or whatever.
That book is fascinating. I'm going to disagree with you on two specific things. I would now include that book in that list of cult writers, which I wouldn't have done even 10 years ago, but I think it's achieved that status. And the second thing is, I started working in a bookshop about 2 months after that book was published, and younger listeners will not remember this, but we had a staff meeting in my branch of Waterstones down in Brighton about where in the shop we should stock that book. It was that controversial. Should it be on a front table? Should it be on a shelf? Should it be kept behind the counter? And we decided that it would be on a shelf but not on a table. The point is context. You know, context is not, to quote somebody, context is not a myth. Reading American Psycho in the, let's say, 3 or 4 years ago as something which has achieved a degree of cultural legitimacy, which it didn't have in the era you're talking about, or I'm talking about, when it was published.
And Bret Easton Ellis has become a respected establishment.
I think that does affect how you read it. So that I can go into American Psycho knowing it's not the work of a, let's say, for the sake of it, a new writer or a controversialist, but the work of somebody with a track record and, you know, what we would say a lot of bottom end, and see it in that context. Also, it really made me laugh. Sorry, everybody. Some of the descriptions of the records in that book are just brilliant, sustained bits of comic irony, you know, so I'm sorry.
Listening to Little Atoms, I'm Neil Denny, and I'm talking to Andy Miller, and we're talking about his book, The Year of Reading Dangerously, How 50 Great Books Saved My Life. And, Andy, we're going to start looking at some of the books you choose out of a list of 50. I was going to say deliberately, it might not, it might be accidental, but I've chosen I've chosen about 10 books to talk about over the course of the next two parts of the show. Only one of them I've actually read myself. One book here out of this 10 I absolutely adore. It's one of my favourite books ever, but literally it's the only one we're going to talk about today. And I'm not going to...
Are you going to say which one it is?
Not yet. So I think when we get there, I probably will. But it isn't The Master and Margarita by Mikhail Bulgakov, a book that I also have known about and wanted to read and thought I should probably read and thought I would probably very much like, but somehow have never gotten around to it for years. And this is the first book you talk about out of the 50. Mm. Why this one?
I think the thing with The Master and Margarita is that we were talking earlier on about it, weren't we? I think the thing about that book is... it probably fulfills the criteria of being both a classic and a cult book. And that's probably one of the reasons why I felt I ought to read it. And you, as you say, you feel you ought to have read it. Mm-hmm. But it's also, as we were talking about it, I was thinking, but it's also a book about which actually perhaps it's very difficult to bluff. You know, there's lots of other books I talk about in here, like Moby Dick. We could have a conversation about Moby Dick. We probably both get away with it. We could have a conversation about Pride and Prejudice. We probably both get away with it. I don't think we could do that with The Master and Margarita. And there is a very specific reason for that, which is that it's a very strange book and a very difficult book to get your head around. It's not a difficult book to read. You know, the translations are good, the prose is straightforward, but it's an incredibly difficult book to boil down into specific themes, images, or plot. The only way you're going to find into that book is by reading it. Mm-hmm. So that's probably one of the reasons why it loomed so large. I probably also felt that there was more to be... I sound terrible saying this. I must have felt at some level it was one of the most impressive books to choose.
Mm.
That having read it and being able to say you'd read it was more impressive than saying you'd read, I don't know, Villette.
Well, I think, first of all, it's, you know, all the Russians are pretty impressive anyway, but there's something... there's something countercultural and there's something, I don't know, there's just something cool about this book.
Yeah,
you can't
I think
say
that's
about
right.
Anna Karenina or...
Yeah,
or,
I think that's right.
You know, or Dostoevsky or something.
Yeah.
I don't know what it is. I don't know why...
No, I don't know what it is either. I mean, the thing is, what's so fascinating about it is it seems to... The Master and Margarita seems to exist, like I say, at that perfect midpoint between a classic and a cult book. There's a film of it. There are stage adaptations of it. It gets name-checked all the time. Never quite goes mainstream, though, does it? Ever.
This, I should say, this is not a book where you're basically saying, here's 50 books everybody should read. This is not like, this is a book I'm talking about, it's great, you should go out and buy this book. It's very much filtering your own experiences of reading this book. And so I saw, this is a book, Master and Margarita is a book that I've wanted to read for years, and was really pleased that you'd chosen this as the first book in the thing. Read your description of it and then thought, I don't want to read that now. You know, you didn't, you weren't supposed to be selling it to me.
No.
But I was sort of, I guess, disappointed in the fact that I thought, this is not a book that I'm going to enjoy. Like, you made it seem exactly what it is, which is, you know, a difficult and tough book and one that is an impressive one to have read, but I really wanted, this is one that I wanted to be like, you to come out and say, yeah, you know, this is, it's a book by a Russian, it's difficult, it looks tough, but it was bloody amazing.
Yeah, well, I did really enjoy it, and I did think aspects of it were really amazing. But you know, it's nice of you to say specifically, you know, the book is not, I'm not trying to sell you those 50 books. I'm trying to capture different types of reading experience, and... so I don't need you, I don't need any reader to agree with me or be inspired by the things that I was inspired by. I just need people to be able to say, well, I didn't feel the way about that way about that book, but I felt it about another book. Mm-hmm. And in the case of The Master and Margarita, you know, I was sufficiently inspired both by the book itself, and I did like it, but also by the fact of having read it, to go on to the next one.
Yeah.
And I should say that at the time when I read it, I had a young family and I was commuting up to London every day. And so the act of reading a book for its own sake was actually quite a startling and unusual thing for me to do. And so what mattered about The Master and Margarita is that I enjoyed it enough to go on to the next one.
Yeah, so was that like a big enough hurdle for you to say, well, actually, this project is a...
Well, the project at this point had no... I wouldn't have even described it in those terms. I think I was just trying to get back to the point of choosing books for myself and enjoying reading them for their own sake. And fortunately for me, with The Master and Margarita, I had the resolve to get through the first half of the book, and I enjoyed the second half of the book very, very much, the overall experience of which was enough to push me on to the next one.
Yeah.
And certainly for the first few books that I talk about, that's really what it was about. It was about setting my mind on doing something.
Yeah, and because you don't, having read that, decide to reward yourself with a nice, easy one. And we're going to talk about a random selection of books. We're not going to do the first 10, but the next one is the second book that you go on to. And it's Middlemarch, again, a book that you've already mentioned earlier. But this is a tough one.
Yeah, I read Middlemarch by George Eliot. I wanted to read, I think, again, you know, I'm slightly having to remember back, but I think I wanted to read it because it's held up as the paradigm of the classic English novel. Mm-hmm. I have an English degree. I'd never read it. I seem to remember Salman Rushdie appearing on a chat show in the 80s and saying he'd never read it. It's the classic English novel which it's all right not to have read. So it seemed to suggest push itself forward as the next one to read. And I have to say, I had a similar experience to the one with Master and Margarita, which was that I started reading it. I found it incredibly hard work. My lovely wife gave me the brilliant tip of reading 50 pages a day, which sounds like the most reductive kind of unimaginative way to do it, but you know what, she was right. It's not easy. It's hard work. And so I would read 50 pages a day of this, whatever it is, 700 page 800 page novel, and I'd say the first 300 pages the first week of reading it were hard work. It was like homework. But great books like that are complex and seductive, and as it went on, I started to think, okay, well, I don't understand everything that's going on, but you know what? I'm getting my brain into gear. It's beginning to get easier, and Eliot is doing a lot of the heavy lifting for me. I just need to kind of go with the flow. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I have to add that I'm not coming at this from a position of complete ignorance. I love reading. I've read a lot of books. I'm not saying I've read nothing, and so this is like virgin territory to me. It's not at all. But I hadn't done much reading like this for a long time. And actually, reading, I think, is like running or a physical exercise or anything like that, that you get better at it the more you do it. And certainly I found with reading all 50 books, I think if I'd read Middlemarch at the end, I would have found it much easier because I'd got my stamina up, apart from anything else. You know, when you go into a book like Middlemarch or Moby Dick or, I don't know, Paradise Lost, let's say Paradise Lost, the purpose of the writer of that book is not necessarily to entertain you. It's to start painting a portrait, which you will only appreciate when you can see the whole thing. And that's the lesson I really got from I got from Middlemarch, I think, which stood me in very good stead, which was dig in. Because it's, you have to go to it. It's not going to come to you.
You've already mentioned this in the first part, but you know, this idea that, you know, if you don't enjoy Middlemarch, that's your fault. It's not George Eliot's fault.
But I think that's
very true. It's a really good point. And I think, you know, I know a lot of friends talk about Middlemarch as being, you know, the great novel of English. You know, the great English novel, as you've also already mentioned. But it does strike me as being the one out of all of these books that is most like homework, is a book that I would read because it would do me good to read it. And I'm not suggesting that's a bad thing. That's clearly a good thing. But there's also, again, you know, I don't want to say there's not enough time and too much stuff, like I said in the first part, but why would you suggest that people should read Middlemarch?
You know, Middlemarch is not a good example, actually, of the thing that you're talking about, and I've sold it short by saying it was, you know, the point is, it started as homework, it ended as pure pleasure. There are other books that I could mention that started as homework and stayed as homework. Mm-hmm. And to some extent, I suppose, why should people persevere is what you're asking. Well, it depends what they want to do with that knowledge, with that learning. I suppose learning is what it is, you know, with that experience. What do you want to do with that experience? Mm-hmm. I guess the context that I talk about is that we live in an era where you are encouraged at all times to express your opinion quickly, openly, you know, on websites or on Twitter or on Facebook. And the drift, I think, is towards the opinion being more important than the experience. Mm-hmm. Where I would tweet my opinion of Middlemarch, you know, my opinion of Middlemarch on page 100 would not be my opinion of Middlemarch on page 600. But by that time, I'd have already tweeted my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
And so to some extent, I moved to say, well, stick with things, partly as a corrective to that, actually. Mm-hmm. You know, in a sense, in a true sense, it's reactionary. It's a reactionary point of view. But I feel the drift is so much in the other direction. Also, I have to speak from a writer's perspective. Mm-hmm. You know, I read a brilliant quote by Roald Dahl today, which is, he said, "I don't mind if readers hate one of my stories as long as they finish the book." That's kind of how I feel as a writer. You're entitled to your opinion, but, you know, it took me 7 years to write my book. How long would it take you to read it? It's not going to take you 7 years, is it? It's going to take you like 2 days. So do write by me. You know, I haven't gone into it to baffle or bore you. I've gone into it to entertain you. You're entitled not to be entertained. But I think, and I agree with that, I don't mind if people don't like my stuff and tell the world about it. But I prefer them to do it from a position of information rather than ignorance.
I'm Olivia Lang, and you're listening to Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture.
The next one I want to talk about is a book I knew nothing about. I'd heard of it, but I knew the title, but knew nothing whatsoever about its contents before reading your book. And it's, of all of the books you talk about, is the one that I most want to read. And it might surprise you which one it is. It's The Sea, the Sea by Iris Murdoch.
Brilliant.
Tell us about... Well, just tell us what this book is about, because it just sounds amazing.
Great. I'm really pleased that of all the books that you should want to read as a result of reading The Year of Reading Dangerously, you should choose The Sea, the Sea by Iris Murdoch. Okay. The answer to the question, what is the Sea about? I don't know. I've read it twice now. I don't really know, Neil, to be honest with you. What I do think is brilliant about the Sea, and I'm sure this is true of Dame Iris's other work too, is that one of the things I learnt from writing this book and reading all these books is that I really don't subscribe to any death of the author theory. I think one of the things that's remarkable about the Sea is it's as an expression, a life mask of Dame Iris's personality.
Mm-hmm.
That it's held together by her preoccupations, her interest in religion, philosophy, and terrible cooking. And, you know, to some extent, it's the glue that holds The Year of Reading Dangerously together.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's a book... What you asked me, what is the link between those 50 books? The link is I wanted to read them and then choose which ones I wanted to write about. And so the Sea is, on one level, is a story about a man who has been a successful actor and retires to the coast. But he then becomes obsessed with a woman who lives nearby who he realises, or at least thinks he was in love with when he was younger. But then in turn it becomes about a story about a kidnapping, and then it becomes a story about seeing monsters out in the bay. I mean, it is one strange book. And yet, rather like The Master and Margarita, in fact, what you can't comprehend knowingly perhaps seeps into you unknowingly. And, you know, I specifically talk about in the chapter that I write about the Sea that one of the things that I found baffling about the book was the narrator prepares a series of really horrendous sounding meals for himself, which I couldn't... I read them and I thought, well, what is this? Is this supposed to be funny or not funny? Or what is it? So I did some research online and found that no two people who write about this book can agree what they're there for, which greatly appealed to me. And we had a friend of mine around to dinner who loves the book, and he said to me, well, they're funny. They're just funny. Find them funny. Relax. Find them funny. Being given permission to find them funny, I did find them very funny. I actually prepared a few of them. They were horrible. They were horrible, but what was great about it was that it was such a good way. I mean, I'd make it sound very larky, and I suppose it was quite larky, but it was also such a good way to engage with the book.
Yeah.
right, to meet the author on their terms and try and work it out. And again, you know, that book really stayed with me. That book is one of the books in this that has, like Moby Dick actually, that has real, you can't understand what's going on, but you might well dream about it, or you might well not be able to shake it, the feeling of it. You know, and one of the things I also really loved about The Sea, the Sea, I really like books where the narrator is a bit of an idiot, but it's not immediately apparent to you that that's the case. And I have at various points in my book attempted to to convince you that I might be an idiot. And certainly Araby, who is the narrator of The Sea, the Sea.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
You start off thinking, well, this seems reasonable. And then within 100 pages, you're thinking, what? This guy's an idiot. So Murdoch is really playing with your expectations of the reader. The expectation, I think, that you have in the modern novel that you need to like somebody. You know, he's thoroughly unlikable. Mm-hmm. No one likes him as much as he does. It's up to you to try and find a way through it.
Okay, well, the next book we're going to talk about also contains a narrator, a protagonist, that actually I don't think it takes so long to realise what a terrible person he is. And this is the only book of the 10 I'm going to talk about that I've read, and I absolutely love.
Hooray!
It's a Confederacy of Dunces.
A Confederacy of Dunces.
Which is a book that at the period of time when I first read it, you know, in my early 20s or something, was... it's a terrible thing to confess, but this was a book that I would judge people on whether they had read or not, and I would buy for new girlfriends and all of that.
that
terrible
well.
Thing. Yeah, exactly. It went down as well as you could possibly imagine that going down on a numerous occasions. But tell us why we should read A Confederacy of Dunces.
Okay, well, my reason for thinking people should read A Confederacy of Dunces will not be yours. Okay, I tell you about A Confederacy of Dunces. I don't really say this in the book, but I'm going to say it because it's funny. I'm so sick of people telling me about how brilliant A Confederacy of Dunces was that I had lied about it just for a quiet life, right? And certainly, writers love telling you how brilliant it is. I know a lot of writers through my professional life. They are the people who are the ones who will tell you how great A Confederacy of Dunces is. And so I took great pleasure in, when I finally read A Confederacy of Dunces, of realising that the reason why writers like that book so much is because the central character, Ignatius J. Reilly, is like a misanthropic idiot who lives with his mum and hates everybody, like many writers do, I would go so far as to suggest. And actually, given that John Kennedy Toole was a failed writer in his own lifetime, there's almost certainly a degree of, it is a very funny but very savage self-portrait, I would suggest, as much as anything else. And so I found the humour of it really grim, actually. I found it a depressing book, which made me laugh. But I also ended up thinking it was utterly brilliant formally, which I think when I started reading it, I was thinking, okay, well, I can see what the trick is. The trick's going to carry on like this. Actually, it's a bit like Catch-22 in that respect, that it has a it sets itself at a pitch. It holds that pitch. But again, you need to read the whole book mm-hmm. to realise how intricate it is, how clever it is structurally. You know, these all sound like technical things, but actually, if those technical things don't exist, then the novel wouldn't affect you in the way that it did. I mean, I don't know how many times have you read it?
I read it at the time probably 3 or 4 times, but probably again not for 15 years or something.
But you feel you carry it around with you, right?
Yeah, I feel that there was a period of time when it was an incredibly important book to me.
Mm.
I don't really know why. I mean, I sort of enjoyed it, and I thought, again, I mean, I think I was also bought up the myth of the book as well. The origin story of the book as well, which, as you mentioned, Kenny Toole, you know, he's a failed writer. He ends up committing suicide, and then his mother touts the book around for years and years and years, eventually gets it published, and it becomes a success. I mean, that's the...
It is, yeah, which is another reason I have to, as I suggest, that writers like it so
well,
much.
Well, I was going to...
Because it confirms the idea that all publishers are idiots.
Yeah.
I
was going to say that writers might love this book, not just because it's technically brilliant, but because it's sort of saying that whatever happens, it might turn out well in the end. You know, your stuff might get loved one day, even though you're constantly being rejected.
One of the other things I like about it is it's... I can't remember if there has ever been a film adaptation of A Confederacy of Dunces. I think there has.
I've never seen it.
Hard to envisage how it could work in any medium other than words on a page.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, even as an audiobook, I can't see how that would be a huge success. I've never tried to listen to it, and I don't know. But there's something essentially writerly about the... construction of it. It exists in the best possible format that it can do, and there's a kind of the anger of it, actually, I think is really stayed with me more than the humour of it. It's funny,
mm-hmm.
it's really funny, but boy is it furious in all senses of the word. It really rampages forward until it stops.
I'm Alex Cox, and this is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture.
In the chapter that you talk about The Confederacy of Dunces, you talk about a couple of other books as well, and one of them is the next one I want to bring in,
mm-hmm.
which is a writer that's... I've never read any of his stuff, but he's constantly being recommended to me by not least one of the other presenters of this show, but, you know, people of a similar age to me. And this is 20,000 Streets Under the Sky by Patrick Hamilton.
Yeah, Patrick Hamilton.
Tell us about... that book and him, I guess, particularly. And
Patrick Hamilton, the reason why I wanted to read Patrick Hamilton is he seemed to represent a particular kind of author that it seemed vitally important to have an opinion about, and moreover, the sort of writer that I would really like,
mm-hmm.
which actually reading any of his books might stand in the way of me being able to... which is very unfair, but... there is a certain kind of Guinness-drinking 30, 40-something man for whom Patrick Hamilton is a totemic author or individual, I think. So I read 20,000 Streets Under the Sky, which is generally perceived to be his best book, I suppose, although it is actually an anthology of 3 of his novels.
Mm-hmm.
And I've also recently just finished reading Hangover Square, which is another of his famous books. And you know, he's a very enjoyable writer, he's a good writer... my understanding of his work was deepened by actually having read it, and yet what I would say about him probably hasn't changed that much compared with what I used to say about him when I hadn't read it. Now, that's not... These are all things I'm saying against myself, I ought to add. I really like what I've read of Patrick Hamilton, but I also have to say that you know, when I was 15, I read Brighton Rock by Graham Greene, and that sort of changed me forever, really. I've read pretty much everything Graham Greene wrote. Often several times.
Mm-hmm.
And so coming to Patrick Hamilton relatively late, it's very hard for me to see him as a sort of slightly easier Graham Greene, a less complex Graham Greene. You know, Hamilton is utterly brilliant on pub life, and the writer Dan Rhodes talks about this quite a lot, and he's absolutely right. But I find the melodrama quite difficult to deal with. And there isn't either the audacity in the prose that you would get with Graham Greene or the torment you know, not just the kind of sexual torment, but the Catholic guilt and the way Green is brilliantly able in some books to weave his work into what's happening in the geopolitical realm as well.
Is the appeal, and I guess we could say this about John Kennedy O'Toole as well, in that a lot of the resonance of the book comes out of the wider story of its writing and its publishing. You mentioned earlier, you know, the idea of the death of the author, which is this idea that the actual authority invested in the book should be the person who's reading it and what they bring to it and what they get out of it. Perhaps the polar opposite of that is this idea that the entire life of the thing that seems attractive about Patrick Hamilton's oeuvre is Patrick Hamilton, the writer, his lifestyle, and therefore that's why the books are appealing rather than the actual books.
Yes, I think there is an element of truth to that. I increasingly think that a novel, one of the ways we could see a novel is as a conversation between the writer and the reader. And actually, as you will know from the people you meet in everyday life, the standards of conversation you might have with one person will not be the same that you might have with another person. It's based on what you have in common, what your background is, etc., etc.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
When you drive a vehicle so reliable it's backed by a 10-year, 100,000-mile limited warranty, you stop thinking about what you can't do and start doing what you never thought possible. Visit your local Kia dealer today to see what you're capable of in a vehicle that inspires confidence around every corner. Kia. Movement that inspires. Call 800-333-4KIA for details. Always drive safely. Limited inventory available. Warranties include 10-year, 100,000-mile powertrain and 5-year, 60,000-mile basic. Warranties are limited. See retailer for details.